Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
James Beard. You know the name and the prestigious awards in his name, but do you know anything about him? We're going to find out a lot today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And James Beard, indeed, is a name that we hear all the time in the food. Those who are interested in food and pick up food magazines, look at the front of cookbooks or restaurants who have received the prestigious award. But, you know, very few people know that much about him. And today I'm talking with two entrepreneurial young women and film documentary producers, Beth Federici and Kathleen Squires, who have produced an incredible full-length feature-length film, documentary film, all about James Beard. And it is going to air on PBS on May 19th all around the country. Check your various PBS listings for that, and I am so excited to be here to talk with them. Welcome. Kathleen is here in the studio with me. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me, Linda.
And Beth is joining us from Oregon, and she's on the telephone. Beth, are you there?
I am here.
Hi.
Thanks for having us, Linda.
Nice to be speaking with you. Well, first of all, I have to commend you personally for doing this film, because I think it's such an important topic. But one of you pipe in and tell me why did you choose James Beard as a topic?
Well, Beth and I
want to take that, Kat?
Yeah. I was going to say Beth and I are old college friends, and Beth is a documentary filmmaker. I'm a food writer,
and that was my error. I have to backtrack. I was going right to my last page and forgot to give your bios. Indeed, Kathleen, you are a writer, a cookbook writer as well, mm-hmm. and a food writer, many other writers, and filmmaker. And Beth, you are a documentary filmmaker. Go on.
So we wanted to collaborate because I think Beth saw the rise in food and film kind of intertwining beyond what had already been out there. So we were thinking of how can we put together our talents. The idea didn't quite gel, though, until one day when I was coming back from lunch at the James Beard House.
Uh-huh.
And I was Skyping with Beth, and I told her, oh, I just came back from the James Beard House. I had a wonderful lunch. And she said, what? You can eat lunch at James Beard's house? And I said, oh, yes, you can have dinner there 5 nights a week. And they put on a lot of events. And we started chit-chatting about that. And Beth is based in Portland, Oregon, and a big fan of it. And I told her that James Beard was from Portland.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And she didn't know that. And we started to talk about how people really know so little about James Beard. And that's when Beth asked me, has anyone made a film about the man? And I said, not to my knowledge.
Yeah. Well, the film is called America's First Foodie. Right?
James Beard, America's First Foodie, yep.
And it's interesting because James Beard, this is the first film about him, and yet he was the first food person or cooking chef on television in America. So it's interesting that there are two firsts. He is the first, right? Beth, you are a documentary filmmaker, but had you made a film about food or a food personality before?
I had not. This was my first entree into this world, and Kathleen was a wonderful tour guide for me and introduced me, obviously, to all the wonderful people that are in the film. If it really hadn't been for her connections in the world, I think this would have probably taken us a lot longer. So it was really a wonderful meeting of the minds and talents. My other films have been ranged from a Bosnian refugee family to 1970s architecture collective. So kind of runs the gamut.
Well, and with any documentary, obviously, that shows your other types of films that it involves a lot of research and talking to a lot of people. In fact, how long did it take to put this together?
4 years.
Yeah, 4 years from beginning to end.
Years.
Which, in the documentary world, is actually a little less than the average. So,
oh, interesting.
We're pretty proud of that.
Yeah. Well, how much? So, you didn't really know that much about his life. Did you know much about his life, Kathleen?
I knew a bit because I'd been a member of the foundation for 20 years, and as a food writer, of course, you can't help but read the works of James Beard and enjoy his recipes. So, I knew a bit about him, but not quite as much as I know now.
Yeah. Well, let's back up a little bit for our listeners, because you knew about him through the foundation. You went to eat there. A lot of people don't know that soon after his death, there was a foundation was formed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So James Beard died in 1985, and his townhouse was going to be put up for sale. And a group of people, including Julia Child and Peter Kumpf and personal friends of James Beard, Caroline Stewart, who was his assistant, who was in our film, gathered together. Larry Forgione was one of them, too. Wolfgang Puck. Jonathan Waxman. They gathered together and banded together to see what they could do to save the house and to establish a culinary foundation in his name.
And so there are well-known chefs from around the world who come in and are asked to come in and cook dinners for the members of the foundation. And as you say, every night there's another dinner or lunch or an event, and it's really quite spectacular. And, you know, it's a fun event to go to if you have the opportunity when you're in New York City. When you were started approaching this film and learning more about him and his contributions to the food world, I guess, Beth, for you, was there anything particularly surprising about his life that you tripped up upon?
Yeah, you know, I would say I started my research with Delights and Prejudices, which is his own autobiography that he published in 1964. Mm-hmm. And he just writes so delightfully about his childhood in Oregon, in Portland. And I think one of the surprises was how what an incredibly strong and powerful woman his mother was. You clearly can see the connection between his love and knowledge about food and her obsession with food and knowledge about food. And then also, I think the thing that we talk about a lot is the fact that there was this gentleman, Juliet, who was a Chinese chef that had worked with his mom in her boarding house and then came over to their personal house to work with her. She entertained a lot, so he was there to help her a lot. And he really became James Beard's kind of godfather. His own father was kind of in and out of the picture. Mm-hmm. And he had this incredible Asian West Coast influence that he took with him to New York and was with him for the rest of his career. So I think that was really interesting. Obviously, him getting asked to leave Reed College for his homosexual activities, I think, had come as a surprise. I mean, Kathleen told me a little bit about that, but as I read both the biography about him and his own writings, I found that interesting because Reed is such a liberal place, but it was the 1920s, and you have to kind of keep all of that in perspective, what was going on in this country in the 20s, prohibition, other types of kind of prohibitive rulings. And so I found that really interesting as well.
That's right. And Kathleen, how about you? Anything that you knew a lot about him already, but anything in all the research you did for the film that kind of jumped out and said, wow, I never knew that?
I never knew his role in establishing City Meals on Wheels mm-hmm. with Gail Green. So I found that very surprising. Mm-hmm. And just to see into the organization that it has grown into today is astounding. And I think a great example of James Beard's legacy today.
It's interesting. Yeah, there's so, he touched so many facets of the food world and not just cooking. And actually, he's often been hailed as the father of American cooking, the first foodie, yes, but really father of American cooking. There's that wonderful quote that Julia Child said, you know, in her voice I can hear, I brought French cuisine to America, but James Beard brought American cuisine to America, which is so true. Yeah. You mentioned that he was asked to leave Reed College, and that, of course, when you read a lot of the background information on him, it doesn't say, it rarely says why. And today, you know, it can, you know, it comes out, and of course, it was in his autobiography. But he never let that deter him, and certainly it did not in many ways. I mean, he went on to be a very flamboyant figure in many ways, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And first appeared on television in 1946. I mean, that was, you know, groundbreaking, for
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. They weren't even sure television was actually going to make it as a medium.
That's so, right.
which is hilarious when you think about that. But yeah, so he was really early.
And Linda, back to surprising things. I think when we found some footage of James Beard, I was really surprised at how bad he was on television.
Yes, yes.
Especially because of, you know, the big personality that he had and the stories people would tell, you would think he would be a natural, but he kind of froze up. He was a deer in the headlights.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And he would be on with other people often, which was so much better for him. When he was sitting alone in front of the camera was not his forte.
No.
Definitely
exactly.
Not. Yeah. But he had such a great face.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I love the fact that your promo for the movie is, I will post that on the page, and you can see that a lot if you Google James Beard, the first foodie, the movie. It's a great picture of his face, and it just, and there's warmth and yet I don't know, some authority and knowledge and a little twinkle in his eye.
Yeah,
like he's got some secrets back there.
Absolutely. And he had a great voice. I mean, he did, he did a lot of radio work. It was hard to track down because radio back in those days, they didn't really keep the tapes. You know, they would tape over things. Same thing with television.
Right.
So it was hard to find a lot of those early radio interviews, but I think he was probably much better on the radio than he was on television because he had that fabulous voice.
Yes, and presence, a big man, you know, with a big presence. You know, talking about finding footage and finding radio interviews, that was one of my main questions for the two of you is, you know, yes, I see you. There's this exhausting list of participants who you interviewed for the film. But finding primary sources, you know, seeing him on television and hearing him on the radio, and were these some of the more difficult challenges for you in trying to find out about his life?
Absolutely, absolutely. Bringing anybody who has passed away to life in a visual medium, especially when they didn't necessarily work in a visual medium, they worked in the printed page, was a big challenge. And we were lucky. He, in his own archive that was left and now lives at NYU at the Fales Library. And the folks over there, Marvin Taylor and his crew, were incredibly helpful. They had stuff in their own collection that were gems, copies of a few things. And then the Food Network actually had some of those early TV shows that they had acquired, and they lent to us. But there's just not that much out there that actually exists of the moving image. And so, yeah, we had to be creative in how we could kind of bring his story to life visually. And that's when we decided to use animation. So the animation, I think, is really charming, and it also helps to kind of fill in that gap of that missing kind of moving image footage.
All right.
And one thing people should know is that those animations, most of them, are actually based on the original illustrations that were in his autobiography, Delights and Prejudices. And I was really fortunate to track down Earl Solander's daughter, and she gave us permission to use those drawings and animate them. So they have a direct tie to James Beard, not just in their context, but in the fact that he had a very good relationship with Earl and loved his drawings and felt that his drawings kind of evoked James Beard's own kind of whimsical spirit, and I agreed. So we were really grateful we could use those.
Yeah, that's a wonderful little tidbit to know about that, you know, before going into, you know, watching the film and hearing that. And have to, you know, we have to remember that he was born in 1903, and where the food world has come since that time. I mean, to really be a pioneer, and as you say, to try to make a movie about a person who was, you know, born before this whole television craze, even though he was on television, was, I'm sure, challenging. Kathleen, I've got the list here of all the people you and Beth spoke to and interviewed, and who actually even appeared in the film, many of them. That in itself, just, you know, talking to one person and finding out, oh, you should talk to another person. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did that work for you?
Worked out really well, as a matter of fact, because everyone so readily stood up and said, we want to help tell his story. And then they directed us to other people, and people helped us track down people we may not have otherwise have found easily. So that worked really well. And just the fact that people were so eager and we didn't have to really beg them was terrific.
Yeah, it seems like everyone always loves to talk about him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they,
yeah,
you know.
Exactly.
And he taught so many people to cook.
Oh yes,
I mean, he was really quite the teacher, and that was a business that he kept up for a long time. Right?
He was. I think that was his real passion, was teaching and being a mentor. And the chefs today, I mean, Jonathan Waxman, James Beard was his mentor, and people like Larry Forgione, and even the new generation, like Mark Forgione, feels the, you know, James Beard, the hand of James Beard, as we like to say, in his cooking today.
Yeah. And there, I mean, it's interesting because in the list of people, there are people who knew him well personally and also people, as you say, who he taught to cook, who are, you know, much younger of today's generation. And then there are people who actually studied him. So it's a very interesting list of people. And this list that I have, these are all those who were interviewed in the film.
Oh yeah, this is the full list of everyone that we had spoken to. Yeah,
yeah.
It was quite extensive. I mean, we ended up with over 100 hours of footage from talking with all of these people.
At which point, we must acknowledge Greg Snyder, who was the editor of the film.
Oh,
yes.
And he's a genius.
In what was probably the most difficult part of making this film for you in terms of where, I don't know, well, first of all, let me ask, what slant did you want to give it? I mean, what were you trying to, you know, what's the theme? What were you trying to present?
Well, I think we were trying, I mean, we've always said that it was kind of a century of food through the lens of this one man. I mean, that was kind of our goal, was how, you know, make it a personal story, make it fun and funny, and make him a whole human being, but also show, that, you know, how the food world evolved over these 9 decades. And I think probably the hardest part and the biggest challenge was what we ended up having to leave out. Like I mentioned, we had to leave out the story about Gillette, and we had to leave out the story about Helen Evans Brown, who was his dear friend, and his longtime editor published a book called Love and Kisses in a Halo of Truffles that was all their letters back and forth. I mean, they wrote to each other 5 times a week for 14 years, from basically 1950 to 1964 when Helen died of cancer. And so you also, through their letters, you can just see how the food world and writing and radio and talking about food was just, it was just exploding. And so I think that was the challenge, was what had to go. And a PBS hour is, you know, it ended up being 52 minutes of content, and, you know, trying to cover 9 decades in 52 minutes is, you know, it was a bear. So we're really, really proud of what we were able to accomplish. And we know there'll be people who will say, well, you left out so-and-so. Well, believe me, we had to leave out a lot of so-and-sos
I'm
at
sure.
the end of the day.
I'm sure. It's just, you know, that's... Of course, that always leaves room for more, right?
People, the sequel.
Yes, right, the sequel. Well, I want to ask you some questions about some of those things that were left out, too, when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
To prove my devotion.
Hi, we're back. And I'm talking with Beth Federici and Kathleen Squires. Beth is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and television producer. And Kathleen is a food writer and in newsprint blogs and essays. And she also has just had a book published with Jen Lewis called Greens, a cookbook. Wonderful. And they have produced... They are co-producers on a new film called James Beard, America's First Foodie. And James Beard, of course, is indeed the big name in food, born in 1903 and often hailed as the father of American cookery. If you look in any cook's well-stocked library, you will most likely find one of his books. Some of the more classic titles that are still popular: James Beard Cookbook, Beard on Bread, James Beard's Theory and Practice of Good Cooking, and then a compilation, The New James Beard, which was which was published shortly before he died, I think. There were others, but these were the ones that you most likely will find on people's shelves. And tell me, you've had several different premieres of this around the country of the movie already. Now, the people who are coming to these premieres are obviously people who were either involved in the film or the food world, some organization that took part in it. What were some of the reactions of the people who attended the premieres?
You know, we screened initially at the Sonoma International Film Festival, and I was personally delighted, as I know Beth was as well, that several times throughout the film, people just broke out into applause for seeing familiar faces like Alice Waters come on the screen and hearing her remembrances. And Danielle Ballude and doing the Chef's Deliver program with City Meals on Wheels as an example of James Beard's legacy. People would just start applauding, and I just love that. So that reaction of people who really get it, and they get James Beard's influence. And at that festival, we actually won the Audience Award for Best Documentary. So it was a really great way to start, right, Beth?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, since then, you know, Kathy and I usually stand in the back, and people laugh at all the right spots, and we see people dabbing at their eyes, so we know that they're crying at the right spot.
Yeah.
And that, you know, for a filmmaker, that's what you want. You know, you want to make sure that people find the things that you thought were so funny that they find them funny. So it's been really wonderful. And I have to say that, you know, the participants, nobody saw this until now. I mean, that's my policy, you know, share with participants beforehand. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
And so for all of these people to be so happy, you know, because they didn't know. You know, here's these two gals that come to them like 3 years ago. They kind of go away. You don't hear much from them. And for them to be so happy, that was our main goal, was just that the people that participated and gave us so much of their time walked away feeling that it was worth it, and were proud to be involved in it. So I think for us, it's just, we've been on the cloud.
Yeah, I mean, to hear Clark Wolf, who was a dear friend of James Beard's, tell us that we really got him, and to hear Jonathan Waxman say that everyone should see this film and you needed another hour.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, the man lived a long life, and he was such an, you know, an influencer on the culinary world.
Mm-hmm.
Did you bring anything out in particular, or any statement made about what one of a major influence of his was that came out in this film? We figured this spanned the years of people weren't in America, were not into food and cooking yet, were the gourmet end of it, mm-hmm. where we are today.
I think James Beard made home cooks feel at ease and comfortable and feel capable. He made it very accessible for home cooks. And also, if you look at, for example, he collaborated with the restaurateur Joe Baum on the Four Seasons. He helped write the menu.
Yeah.
He helped the design. And that was 1959. And farm to table at a restaurant was really not a thing yet. And James Beard, now that influence, everybody's farm to table. Everybody wants to claim that.
Right.
Using local ingredients, locavorism. And I think that's where you really feel James Beard's influence today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, maybe, Beth, you being out in Oregon, perhaps it was because he was born in Portland?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came to Portland the first time in 1990 and then just moved back about 5.5 years ago. And so we kind of, he and I did the opposite. He went from Portland to New York, and I came from basically New York, New Jersey to Portland. And, yeah, I mean, without a doubt, the bounty of the Pacific Northwest and the beauty of the Pacific Northwest, I think, you know, he lived in his heart his whole life, and you definitely see that in his recipes.
Right,
I think that if he, you know, people say, like, you know, what do you think he would think about food blogs and everything today? And I think that he would love it. I think that if they have existed, maybe at the end of his life, he might have even considered moving back to Oregon, because you can stay so connected in ways that you couldn't. You kind of had to be in New York if you wanted to be part of that world, you know, at his time. But I think that if he could have been blogging every day from, you know, his front porch in Portland or the coast, he probably would have loved that.
That's interesting. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, he was a contributor to Gourmet Magazine and I think House and Garden or... Mm-hmm. But... You know, there weren't even a lot of the food magazines around that much. You know, I mean, later on, you know, yes, but early on there weren't that many avenues for him to you know, to write and contribute. But I think you're right; he would have stayed in touch. And in his books, you know, I mentioned Oregon, but you know, in his books, he often referred to ingredients, and well, the best ingredient, of course, you have to go to, and he'd, you know, name a state or a location around America. I mean, it was all, you know, about the American bounty, which I thought was really very interesting for a writer at that time to do.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Instead of saying the chanterelles in France right. are the best, he would say, hey, get them from Oregon.
That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah. And as much as the word foodie is derided by by much of the food world, I mean, it is so perfect in describing him. He was America's first foodie, indeed, and loved the food. What was your takeaway, if you will? I mean, I know it's an overused question or phrase, but what was your takeaway from this project, if you could pinpoint any one thing?
Beth, you want to start with that?
Wow. I think my takeaway would be that, he was really influencing the food world very, very early on. And again, like I mentioned, his mother, even before him, she was way ahead of her time at the turn of the century. And I think that people kind of think about, for example, like the home economics movement. We all kind of remember those 50s industrial films, and we think that the Campbell's, you know, canned soup craze started in the 50s. But truthfully, it actually started at the turn of the century, and his mother would have none of that. She was never going to use, you know, any kind of canned soup in any of her recipes. And I think we kind of forget that, you know, that was already happening in the teens, in the 20s, and that he was pushing back as she was and reminding people that you can have great, inexpensive food on your table if you have some guidance and you know where to get the ingredients, and that it really goes back even farther, and that he really was a leader, and he deserves to be getting that credit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For me, I think it was how influential he was, and how prolific in a time before technology. Think about how today people use, you know, social media and the internet and television to get their message out about their mission, whatever it is, whether it be food or not, and how instantly that happens. Well, James Beard, I feel, accomplished that without the benefit of technology and through so many mediums, through his newspaper columns, through his magazine writing, through his cookbooks, through his teaching, through even his television career, paving the way for people like Julia Child and Jacques Pepin.
Right. That's right. And he and his personal connection, I think. He mm-hmm. just had that way of connecting, you know, personally with people. Obviously, all the people you talk to and all the people you interview, I mean, everyone has, you know, something special that they remember, you know, about him, to say about him. Mm-hmm. And I remember, too, that this was back in the day, he would have to do his own commercial. Dione Lucas, one of the early ones right after him, would do their own commercials, have to talk about the products themselves. And then he would flatly refuse to talk about some things that he just didn't, you know, that he really was not a fan of, or that he, you know, didn't think that it was quality. If it was good flour, you know, he would talk about good flour, right?
Yeah.
You have a piece of that. I think you have something in the film about the flour advertisement, you know, talking about it.
Yes.
Those were the silly times on television with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, it is certainly a film that will have an impression on a lot of people, and I think be very meaningful to a lot of people who don't, as I said, don't know anything about him so much, but certainly know his name and just say, oh, yeah, James Beard, and it has to do with food. And now, prestige.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the award is attached, you know, the James Beard Awards through the foundation are attached to, you know, to fine endeavors in the food world, and that was certainly something I think would please him very much. You know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I again thank both of you for sharing your time with me about this film and for the work that you did over all those years, 4 years, wow, on one project. Was there any time, a point that you were ready to throw it, fold it, and say, you know, this is too difficult?
I, I don't think we were ever going to fold it, but we do have to mention that this is a co-production with American Masters. And if it had not been for Michael Cantor, you know, I reached out to him via my contact here in Oregon at Oregon Public Broadcasting, which, by the way, I do have to say one thing. Oregon Public Broadcasting did make a half an hour piece, maybe 10 years ago at this point, that was about James Beard, but it was all about him in Oregon. And it was a short, and so we do have to give them credit, but they, you know, it was not a comprehensive film that covered his whole life, and it didn't talk about New York or any of the other places that he lived. So, but when I reached out to Michael, he just knew that, you know, this was kind of a no-brainer. And oh, yeah. Kathy and I, from day one, had said we think that James Beard should be in American Masters. I mean, literally from the first conversation. So. You know, when they swooped in and said, yes, we will provide you with finishing funds, you know, then we knew we could really bring it over the finish line in a timely fashion. We did do a Kickstarter campaign before that, and we thank all of our Kickstarter supporters, but it was certainly not enough to finish. And so it just might have taken us a lot longer if we had had to kind of nickel and dime it together. So yay for American Masters saving the day.
Well, the American Masters series, and I will mention this again, they will premiere this film on your local public broadcasting systems. Premieres Friday, May 19th. Now, it may not be the same date everywhere, but is it?
Check your local listings, absolutely. Many markets will have it on the 19th, but some are changing it up a little bit for their local, for the benefits of their local audiences. So definitely check your local listings. If you're in New York City, it will be 9 p.m.
May
19th on WNET.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrific.
And I should say that OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting, is one of those stations, and they are going to be airing it on Sunday, May 21st at 7 p.m. So for any of our Oregon listeners, they should know that. So
that's great. Well, easy enough to check your local listings for your local public broadcasting station. And I can't wait. I just think it's going to be it's such an important film. I think you did a good thing.
Oh, thank
really
you.
Did a good thing. He indeed is an important person to be remembered in this way. Thanks again, Kathleen Squires and Beth Federici. Thank you for joining us from Oregon, and thanks for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.